It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night, and it is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Well, I'm sorry this is coming sort of a little late. If I had read my email last week and been well enough to come in, I could have told you a week in advance about the 2010 West Coast Earth First Rendezvous. It's happening starting tomorrow. The 2010 West Coast Earth First Rendezvous and Cascadia Forest Defenders Action Camp is Friday, June 11th through Sunday the 13th, and will be taking place about an hour's drive east of Eugene, Oregon, in the McKenzie Watershed. And there's a city bus that goes out there. It's an opportunity to plug into summer campaigns to defend Oregon's native forests and sharpen direct action and forest-related skills. In addition, workshops will cover a variety of other topics that pertain to many campaigns or activist communities, like forest field checking, knowing your civil rights, and working with the media. If you want to know more, check with forestdefensenow.org for a list of workshops, directions, and more information. And I just happen to have the directions for you, directions to the action camp. We have occupied the site and are happy to tell you, from I-15 or Eugene, take Highway 126 east to just past milepost 43, and before milepost 44, and just past Christmas Treasures, you'll turn on left onto Blue River Reservoir Road, also known as Forest Road 15. Proceed about 4.6 miles, and it's all paved to the action campsite. You'll pass by the Mona campground at approximately half a mile, and the action camp is on two minor spur roads, Road 175 and Road 180. Both of those are on the left-hand side as you head out there. The Road 175, the first entrance to the little loop we are on, is hard to spot and will be marked with pink and orange forest tape. This is a dirt loop which may or may not have parking available. If you drove over a second bridge across the river, you just passed the campsite. However, overflow parking will be over there, so turn around, come back, see if there's parking on Road 180, and then perhaps you might have to go back across the bridge and park your car. Anyway, I hope to see you there. For bus directions from Eugene and more information, visit www.forestdefensenow.org. And that is the 2010 West Coast Earth First Rendezvous. Starts tomorrow, goes through the weekend. Here's the update from the field from the Buffalo Field Campaign, and this will be their last field update for the summer. They'll start up again in the fall. This summer they'll be having road shows. Hopefully we can get them here into Santa Cruz sometime in the fall. We're also, they're having volunteer outreach in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Park. So here we go. Here's the update. We have reached the time of the year when the landscape starts to feel lonely. Most of the buffalo have been hazed off of their chosen ground into Yellowstone National Park, where the grass is not as green. The park visitors hound their every move, and many, many of their kind have already been pushed. We continue patrols after the huge hazing actions of last week, finding one lone bull here, a small family group there. For the most part, the land is empty of our buffalo friends, where once people could enjoy the priceless company of North America's largest land mammal throughout our national forests. The intolerance of Montana's livestock industry forces people to pay $25 to see them in Yellowstone. One very special buffalo has gotten the area's attention lately. However, it's one of those wonderful cases of reprieve that we all need to celebrate. A huge, majestic bull buffalo has been spending his time in and around the town of West Yellowstone over the past few weeks. He has been hazed and continues to return to the green lawns, school fields, and shop front shrubberies of West Yellowstone. Memorial Day weekend, of course, brought many visitors to the little town, and many of those visitors have probably never even been around a wild bison before. So our bull buffalo friend found himself sought out by visitors who continued to get just a little too close, and in some cases, a lot too close. We got word over the weekend that the plan had been put forth to kill this majestic animal after the Memorial Day crowds had left. We knew that he had many friends in town, though, and we went to work reaching out to our allies in the area, the media, and most of all to the visitors who were coming out to enjoy his presence. Other residents put out their own materials, too, to ask for tolerance and space for this bull. We even offered to the town the service of our patrols staying in the area of the bull to ask visitors to keep their distance and to educate them a bit about the plight of the wild bison. Within a matter of days, we got word from the chief of police and from the town council that they absolutely will not kill the bull, and that while he will be pushed again to the confines of Yellowstone National Park, he will be safe while in the streets of West Yellowstone. It is a victory for one beautiful bull, and that comes from all our diverse allies pulling together. Unfortunately, Tuesday's news of victory was followed by Wednesday's hazing. Approximately 60 buffalo, mamas with their yearlings and newborn calves, were hazed by horsemen in a helicopter from the south side of the Madison River, the cattle-free public land of the Gallatin National Forest, to well inside Yellowstone National Park. This was another 14-plus mile day for these moms and calves, one group of whom swam across the rain-swelled Madison in an attempt to escape the haze, only to be harassed again on the other side by more horsemen. Once again, these wild buffalo have been chased from their chosen ground. Once again, a helicopter and horsemen disrupted not just the buffalo, but countless of species of wildlife within the Yellowstone ecosystem, and once again, the law enforcement working on the scene for our safety kept us back from their operations, preventing us, for the most part, from effectively documenting and witnessing this harassment of wildlife. But like the buffalo, we persist. We are out there again today documenting as agents haze the few remaining buffalo off of Cattle Free Horse Butte, forcing them for miles deep into Yellowstone. We are watching the agents' every move, cameras in hand, letting them know that we will always be here to stand with the buffalo they harass, despite their overwhelming law enforcement presence, despite their threats, and anything else they might do. Here's some good news. Late in May, on the 27th, Montana District Judge John Brown ruled against the Montana stock growers who had filed suit to force or kill all wild buffalo that remain in Montana after May 15th of each year. Though the decision came too late for the hundreds of wild buffalo who have been inhabiting the western landscape outside of Yellowstone National Park, Horse Butte residents and the Earth Justice legal team prevailed over rancher interests for the buffalo. What will this court ruling mean for wild buffalo next year? Stay tuned to Earth First Update and the Buffalo Field Campaign updates from the field to find out. If you'd like to help Buffalo Field Campaign, the best thing to do is to go to their website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, and read about their program and what they need. They have special pages about what they need. They do need volunteers for this summer, so consider doing that. And when you've made up your mind to donate something, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. And if you're going to visit, do give a call before you go. Area code 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. And the Rogue River feud has an alternate ending. Since 2007, Wild Oregon has worked with a broad coalition to protect the Zane Grey Roadless area along the Wild Rogue River. The area is named after the famous Western novelist who loved the Rogue. Zane Grey kept a cabin high on the river's banks and wove the Wild Rogue landscape into his stories. In 1948, his book Rogue River Feud was published. Well, Gray tells the story of a conflict between two World War I veterans returning to southern Oregon to fight over honor and salmon. Theirs is not the only feud that has broken out over the Rogue. For years, timber industries and conservationists have fought over the highest and best use of the wildlands surrounding the Rogue River. Should the forest be for wood products or to be protected for to filter the tributary streams that feed the Rogue and maintain the unparalleled beauty of the area? Well, an agreement announced recently helps to settle that question. The timber industry lobby group, AFRC, has agreed to withdraw their opposition to a 58,000-acre wilderness proposal for the Wild Rogue, preferring wilderness to a precedent-setting Wild and Scenic Rivers bill. Oregon newspaper editorial boards think this breakthrough means a chance for Wild Rogue wilderness to finally make it through Congress. Found out more about the Rogue proposal and what you can do to help here by going to www.oregonwild.org. That's www.oregonwild.org. Let's get some biological diversity news in here. 4,400 acres saved from oil and gas hydrofracking. In a victory for clean air, safe climate, wilderness, and wildlife, the Center for Biological Diversity and allies have stopped a 4,400-acre oil and gas drilling plan on West Virginia's Monongahela National Forest. The plan would have trashed a proposed wilderness area, threatened brook trout, and put additional pressure on a nearby population of endangered bats already suffering from white nose syndrome. The plan might have well allowed the use of hydrofracking, also known as hydraulic fracturing, which cracks deep underground rocks with high-pressure water pumps, threatening to pollute streams and aquifers. And a suit has prompted stream restoration. Due to a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity, the City Council of Santa Clarita, California, has announced it will finance restoration of the Bouquet Canyon Creek, the area's last natural waterway. The project will prove that natural creeks work for flood control. Right now, most creeks in the Santa Clara River Valley are lined with concrete. In fact, said the president of the Santa Clarita Organization for the Planning for the Environment, our ally in this case, the creek is really the only place left in the city that's not concrete. Our original lawsuit was filed over a car dealership that was too close to the Santa Clara River. The Santa Clara River system, including the Bouquet Canyon Creek, is home to numerous endangered species, from the arroyo toad to least Bell's vireo to the marvelous unarmored three-spined stickleback, and that's a fish. Habitat refuge has been sought for endangered abalone. To save one of the West Coast's most unique and imperiled invertebrates, the Center for Biological Diversity and sued the Obama administration to force federal habitat protection for the endangered black abalone. This edible shellfish, once common throughout Southern California tide pools, has plummeted in numbers by 99% since the 70s, initially due to overfishing. The species is still severely threatened by climate change, ocean acidification, coastal development, poaching, and the spread of a fatal disease called withering syndrome. After a Center petition, the species was protected under the Endangered Species Act in 2009, but the administration still has not set aside protected critical habitat as required under law. Critical habitat protections have a proven track record helping endangered species to survive, said Catherine Kilduff, staff attorney at the center. Black abalone is on the cusp of extinction, and further delay of habitat protection may seal the species' fate. And tell the Environmental Protection Agency to clean up our oceans. After a Center for Biological Diversity lawsuit, the Environmental Protection Agency took a big step towards requesting public input on how to confront ocean acidification. The EPA seeks information on how it can use the Clean Water Act to guide states to monitor and identify coastal waters that are threatened or impaired by ocean acidification. So action right now can be taken to protect waters through limits on CO2 pollution. Right now, the oceans absorb about 22 million tons of CO2 every day, mostly from the burning of fossil fuels, which is causing seawater to become more and more acidic. Corrosive waters hinder the ability of marine life to protect shells and skeletons, which affects the entire food chain. Related to the center's lawsuit forcing the EPA to address ocean acidification under the Clean Water Act, the center has petitioned every coastal state to declare its ocean waters impaired under the act. Now, by speaking out to the EPA, you can join our campaign to save all the ocean life from one of the worst threats it's ever faced. And I might say that we also won a victory in that the Supreme Court has basically told the Environmental Protection Agency to go ahead and clean up the oceans. Though the Senate doesn't like it, by the way. A little more biodiversity news here. Grazing has been halted to protect Yellowstone grizzlies. Capping a successful campaign by the Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has halted sheep grazing to protect vital grizzly bear habitat on about 7,500 acres of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. The move stems from a settlement of a lawsuit by the Center and Western Watersheds Project to stop the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station from harming endangered species by grazing thousands of sheep on more than 100,000 acres of public lands. Besides threatening bighorn sheep with domestic sheep diseases, the grazing exposed grizzlies, wolves, and lynx to deadly predator control measures like steel leg hold traps and strangulation snares, aerial gunning, and poison. Just last year, sheep station-related activities were responsible for killing two entire wolf packs. The area where grazing was halted provides important connective habitat between Yellowstone and the vast wildernesses of central Idaho. While more grazing restrictions in this area are warranted to protect Yellowstone wildlife, this decision is a big step forward. And the center will push for more habitat protection as the sheep station continues to analyze the environmental impacts of its activities. And a rare desert plant has won 16,000 protected areas. Due to a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed to protect more than 16,000 acres of critical habitat for the endangered Lane Mountain milk vetch. The move countered a Bush administration decision to protect 0 acres for the delicate plant, despite the fact that only 4 populations remain on the planet, and those populations are still declining thanks to off-road vehicles, mining, development, desert military operations, and other threats. Unfortunately, the proposed area leaves out 2 of the 4 sites where the milk vetch is known to stretch its roots, and the center will push for more habitat protection in the final designation. Our milk vetch win is just one of 44 center victories in earning new or additional habitat protections for species harmed by Bush-era political interference with endangered species decision. And Alaskan oil drilling to be canceled for right whale habitat and a win for the world's most endangered whale. The Obama administration announced plans to cancel an offshore oil drilling lease in Alaska's Bristol Bay, including federally protected critical habitat for the North Pacific right whale. The decision came partly in response to a Center for Biological Diversity lawsuit opposing oil and gas development in the area. The whale's critical habitat was won in 2006 after 6 years of legal work by the center. There are probably fewer than 50 Northern Pacific right whales in the Northeast Pacific Ocean and perhaps 100 left in the Northwest. The center earned Endangered Species Act protection for the whale as a distinct species in 2008. And the wolf hunt has ended in Idaho and Montana after killing 500 wolves. As Idaho's wolf hunting season finally came to a close, the Center for Biological Diversity and wildlife lovers across the country mourned the killing of more than 500 imperiled Northern Rockies gray wolves by hunters and the feds. The Idaho hunt, plus a similar season in Montana, followed the Interior Department's 2009 removal of those states' wolves from the federal endangered species list, along with a green light in both states to reduce their wolves' populations to just 100 and 150 animals in each state. Right now, the Yellowstone ecosystem has only 76 breeding individuals, while scientists say the wolves need hundreds, if not thousands, of breeders to avoid genetic unraveling. Beyond the animals needlessly shot, hunting wolves disrupts family bonds, can leave pups to starve, and contributes to a dangerous genetic isolation of wolves in Yellowstone, said the center's Michael Robinson. We are eager to see Northern Rockies wolves restored to the endangered species list, and the result of these hunts bolster our legal claims. The center and a dozen allies represented by Earth Justice are currently in court to reinstate Northern Rockies Wolves Endangered Species Act protection before it's too late. And if you want more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And now let's take a few minutes and read from the Forest Update for June of 2010. We want to thank Jody Frediani, forestry consultant for the Sierra Club here in Santa Cruz, for preparing this monthly forest update. The SoCal Demonstration State Forest General Management Plan Update. The update process for the SDSF General Forest Management Plan is moving forward. CAL FIRE has realized that they need to reconvene the legislatively mandated advisory committee, which assisted with development of the original GFMP. Since most AC members have moved on, new members are currently being solicited. The advisory committee is required from the Board of Forestry, Santa Cruz County Board of Supervisors, or an appointee, Department of Parks and Recreation, Department of Fish and Game, and the Forest of Nicene Mark State Park Citizens Advisory Committee, which was dissolved in 1999. In addition, the previous advisory committee had a rep from the Nature Conservancy, Soquel Creek Water District, a neighborhood representative, and a local registered professional forester. Apparently, the RPF, the neighborhood rep, and the TNC rep are still available. However, it seems that the Board of Forestry Committee feels that a local land trust should be represented rather than the Nature Conservancy, which was the original holding company of the land. A public notice requesting recommendations for the advisory committee will be circulated and appointments will be named by the Cal Fire director. In the meantime, the department has already begun to prepare a draft of the General Forest Management Plan, which can be found online at www.fire.ca.gov/resource_management. That's MGT/resource_MGT/state_forest_soquel.php. Just go to Cal Fire and keep looking. And the SDSF's 1998 Management Plan Actions and Studies. When the General Forest Management Plan was adopted in 1998, it included a number of action items with completion dates largely by the end of 1999. These included such things as a fisheries management plan with fish population surveys, sediment level monitoring, and aquatic habitat monitoring, an inventory assessment and risk rating of each segment of forest road, and a similar assessment and risk rating of active landslides. On May 3rd, Sierra Club and Central Coast Forest Watch submitted a joint request to CAL FIRE for copies of the various reports that would have been generated by these and additional studies and required actions. In response, we received a letter and a CD with a variety of study reports or summaries. Most were conducted by other agencies, National Marine Fisheries Service or the Resource Conservation District, some specifically for the Soquel Demonstration State Forest, but some simply to monitor Soquel Creek. We are still reviewing those documents. Cal Fire's May 18th letter noted the fisheries biologists and hydrologists dissuaded them from doing specific sediment monitoring and to substitute temperature monitoring instead. Of course, temperatures, which can be related to pool depth or lack thereof from excessive pool filling with sediment, give no information on the quality of spawning habitat. Ecological condition of aquatic habitats to be monitored annually by sampling invertebrates through 1999 and periodically thereafter was sampled once in 1995. The letter further states that some studies and or reports were not conducted or produced due to funding shortages. For instance, no comprehensive report has ever been compiled with requests for emergency responses, including requests for police, fire, medical, and search or rescue services, including the response times. A letter noted that in this case, such reports must be reviewed prior to public release to ensure sensitive information is not disclosed contrary to state or federal law. We don't understand how compiling statistics can violate those laws and are surprised that no emergency services monitoring information is available for public review. Of greater concern, however, is that the required accurate annual reports, which will compile revenues, expenses itemized by program, or cumulative balances, were not only not available, but have never been done. The General Forest Management Plan also states the department will maintain a mailing list for requests of annual distributions of the report. However, the May 18th Cal Fire letter stated that due to lack of local staff, such reports have not been produced. We find this confusing as for years the Soquel Demonstration Forest had two registered professional foresters on staff as well as an administrative assistant. Did they also want an accountant? The letter continues to note that monitoring activities specifically depend on funding to be performed. Therefore, the lack of funding is an acceptable excuse of monitoring delay. Of course, the public has not been given the necessary financial statements to independently evaluate the financial status of the forest. And Soquel Demonstration State Forest Rim Timber Harvest Plan has a greenhouse gas emission. As a result of the passage of AB 32, all projects in California must include a greenhouse gas assessment. Apparently, the first review of CAL FIRE's own RIM-THP on Soquel Demonstration State Forest asked for specific calculations, but the RPF did not feel he needed to comply because, in his own words, the RPF is aware that the department is working on a GHG calculator that will be made available to RPFs online. The search of the department's website while preparing this response letter did not yet yield such a calculator. Furthermore, until a limited timber operator has been contracted and a comprehensive list of equipment can be tabulated, such a calculation would be hasty and inevitably erroneous. Should the department calculator be available prior to plan approval, assuming a LTO has been selected, the RPF shall provide a plan-specific calculation for the record. Once again, we see that CAL FIRE's RPFs feel they are above the law. Remember, a different CAL FIRE RPF illegally allowed a training class to fell redwoods in the area of a proposed but not yet approved timber harvest plan. But the plan preparer in this case was not alone in his assessment. CAL FIRE seems to accept this explanation and justification by the RPF. Tony Lukakik, CAL FIRE second review team chair for this timber harvest plan, made the following admission in an internal email. At the time of the second review, there were two public comment letters, neither of which mentioned greenhouse gas, so I did not worry about plan-specific discussion. Apparently, CAL FIRE thinks that they only need to follow the rules if the public is paying attention. Anyway, there are a few new timber harvest plans in the works. Timber Harvest Plan 1-10-24 SCR. The plan owner is Mildred Holmes. The RPF is Hildreth. And the plan size is 40 acres, and it's on Day Creek off of Boulder Creek. THP 1-10-045 SCR. Owners are William and Ellen Peterson. The Gary Paul is the RPF and comprises 10 acres on Valencia Creek. 1-97 NTMP-27 SCR, Notice of Operations Number 4 on land owned by Eric and Kate Moore, with Gary Paul again being the RPF, is going to work on 30 acres on the east branch of Newell Creek. And 1-10-052 SCR, owners Judith Crawford and Hen Trong, with Hildreth again as the RPF, is going to log 31 acres in Trout Gulch. And in our final we got a couple of minutes here. AB 2575 has passed out of assembly. AB 2575 received enough votes to pass out of assembly and now goes to the Senate. Salmon Protection would direct the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, CAL FIRE, to implement a pilot project for the improved protection and repair of riparian zones in watersheds with listed anadromous salmonids. And we will finish up with a rant on industry self-regulation. Anyone who is not in a coma is painfully aware of the ongoing cataclysmic disaster unfolding in the Gulf of Mexico as a result of the explosion of BP's Deepwater Horizon drilling rig and the ensuing petroleum geyser now filling the Gulf with crude. Of course, there were mistakes, shortcuts, cost-saving measures, bad cement jobs, broken blowout preventers, and on and on. But the most glaring problem I see is that industry was and is essentially conducting self-regulation. What does this have to do with forestry? Well, Tuesday, Jody Frediani attended the Board of Forestry monthly meeting committee meetings once again, and once again I watched and spoke out in opposition as industry lobbyists on the board bashed CAL FIRE and the North Coast Watershed staff for their suggestions on new road rules that would provide better protection for fish and water quality. Both CAL FIRE and the Water Board insisted that the language I'd written would not provide necessary and lacking protection. In fact, as currently drafted, the language would violate the Basin Plan. Department of Fish and Game also chimed in and was blasted because that staffer's comments were stronger than the politically watered-down final comments his department made on the anadromous salmonid protection rules. One industry committee member said he didn't see any problems in the field after CAL FIRE's deputy director pointedly said that CAL FIRE had found that the current rules were not adequate. This management committee is comprised of three board members in this case. Two are industry lobbyists, and one is a new public member, also a registered professional forester, not a fisheries biologist, geologist, hydrologist, but a forester too. Even though the Zeeburg-Nedgedly Forest Practice Act established a public majority on the Board of Forestry to end the previous industry-run regulatory process, the timber industry is still running their own show and dominating the rule promulgation that ostensibly regulates their industry. Please contact your state legislators and let them know that industry lobbyists should not be in charge of developing the rules that regulate them and their clients. This is a complete conflict of interest, and as long as industry lobbyists sit on the board, no committee should be dominated by industry reps. And we'll read some more from Jody's forest report again next week. And that's it for the Earth First update for this week. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this or previous Earth First updates, here's where you can go find them. Go to www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then select Earth First Radio, and all those shows will be available for download. Just a sec. All right. And we want to thank the folks at h2opodcast.com for helping out by recording and archiving those shows. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, and we thank you for listening, and tune in next week for more Earth First updates.